Hello, I'm Hilary Harper here with you on Life Matters. What's on your cereal of a morning? For decades in Australia, most people drank cow's milk, but now it could be soy, rice, almond, oat, you name it. But is soy milk, for example, a health food? Or could it be damaging your hormonal balance? We'll find out the science behind breakfast soon on Life Matters. You might have heard on Life Matters previously that from April 1st, there'll be big changes to the way private health insurance rebates work. So if you're a fan of Bowen therapy, Tai Chi, iridology, reflexology or Rolfing, among other natural therapies, you won't be getting any cash back through your health fund for those. Many people might be thinking, good, why should our taxes be subsidising these therapies? But what if it meant less research into whether those therapies work or limits on health services offering those therapies at all? John Wardle is Associate Professor of Public Health at UTS. Welcome, John.
Hi, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. This is a very complex issue, but let's make it as simple as possible. What was the aim of the legislation around private health rebates that saw those therapies put on a list?
Okay, so the aim ultimately of the legislation was simply to remove the government subsidy for insurers offering these therapies. So most insurance in Australia is subsidised to the tune of around 25%, a little bit more, meaning that if an insurer pays out $100, they get roughly $25 back from the government.
And can you give us a sense of that list so we know what we're dealing with?
Okay, so the list is, there's 16 therapies on that list. And I think one of the confusing things with a term like natural therapies is it does include some fringe therapies, but it also includes therapies like yoga, Tai Chi, naturopathy, herbal medicine, some of which are actually now included in international clinical guidelines, like for low back pain or asthma or cardiovascular care. Treatments that are actually quite evidence-based now. This report is quite old, the evidence that this particular change is based on. It's over 6 years old now. But it does, the list does also include some fringe therapies that probably shouldn't be included in insurance. But the all-encompassing nature of this legislation means that you've got therapies that don't work, that aren't being covered.
And it's just got things like homeopathy, like you mentioned, that's been categorically debunked. So, John Wardle, you're arguing that this is having an impact on other parts of the health system, for example, the hospital system. Can you untangle that a bit for us?
Sure. It is a very complex issue, but ultimately, rather than just changing the legislation to impact the subsidy, which is what the Labor Party actually proposed, the current government have actually removed... Have actually excluded these natural therapies from all elements of the insurance legislation. So this means Rule 11 for general treatment, these natural therapies are excluded, which also excludes them from chronic disease management programs, which is the sort of bundled packaged care. So even if insurers aren't paying for these services directly, they're not allowed to be included in those plans.
So just explain bundling a little bit more for us, for the layperson.
Okay, sure. So if you've got a mental health program, rather than actually pay an individual benefit for one yoga practitioner consult, this is a package of care which includes an individualised plan to actually help people with all treatments that are known to be clinically effective. So you might have a suite of self-care exercises, there may be some self-directed classes, there may be some practitioner visits. So the insurance legislation does allow for people with risk factors for chronic disease to actually attend programs of care rather than just individual consultations. There's also an element called health management plans, which is actually the section of the legislation which allows things like gym memberships or sports memberships or any service which is actually not usually eligible for health fund cover to be included. And natural therapies are also specifically excluded from that piece as well.
So you're saying in a health management plan offered by a hospital, the plan would not be able to be offered if it included one of the therapies on this list?
Well, health management plans are usually general treatment, so they usually occur in an outpatient setting, but Rule 8 relates to hospital treatment, and that very specifically also excludes natural therapies. So what this means is that hospitals, to be compliant with the health insurance legislation in Australia, aren't allowed to integrate or interact their currently reimbursable treatments with any of these natural therapies.
So it wouldn't be technically illegal for them to offer the therapies, though, would it? It would just be administratively a bit more complex. They'd have to set it outside those plans.
Yes, but so complex it would almost be impossible. They'd essentially have to, they wouldn't be able to record it in the same system. They wouldn't be able to bill it through the same system. There wouldn't be able to be any referrals or interactions through through official processes. So it would be a very, very large barrier to integration.
Now, John Wardle, as you know, there are a lot of different voices in this sector, and Life Matters has checked the issue with Private Healthcare Australia, which represents a number of private healthcare funds. They have confirmed that it will be difficult for a private hospital to offer any therapies on the excluded list to their patients. But do you have any concrete evidence that these changes to private health insurance would also affect the public health system, as you're suggesting? Because Life Matters also checked with the Australian Hospitals and Healthcare Association, and they are not aware of any ban on the public system offering those therapies.
I've spoken with insurers and hospitals, and in their briefings from government, the hospital exclusion has not even been discussed. So a lot of groups only thought it was about general treatment. They didn't realise the exclusion was in hospital treatment as well. Theoretically, if public hospitals now actually offer a large suite of private health reimbursable items in Australia, and most hospitals, including public hospitals, develop their services to be compliant with billing legislation such as this. So it's a very complex system. One service in a hospital can be subject to any one of 40 pieces of legislation. So it is a quite complex arrangement. Public hospitals are probably slightly less affected than private hospitals are. Although I think the thing a lot of people don't realise is a lot of public hospitals do actually offer a lot of private outpatient services particularly, and this is where the natural therapies would exist, and they would have to be completely separate from anything that's even eligible for private health insurance rebates, even if that particular patient is not taking those rebates themselves.
You're listening to Life Matters, and we're chatting with John Wardle, Associate Professor in Public Health at UTS, and we're also joined by Leanne Wells, the CEO of the Consumer Health Forum. Leanne, welcome.
Hello, Hilary.
Hi. You were supportive of the move to stop some natural therapies from attracting a subsidy under the private health insurance system when the legislation was passed. Tell us what your rationale was at the time.
Yeah, we were supportive of excluding natural therapies. Where we're coming from as a national consumer body is we stand for health treatments and health spends that deliver the most benefit to the community overall. And we all know that, the health budget has its limits. The scope for spending is vast. So we support the principle that government spending, taxpayer subsidised spending in health really should focus on evidence-based therapies. So the rule of evidence for us is really important. And, in the same way that services are eligible for subsidy under Medicare, under the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, they have to pass a rigorous test for effectiveness and efficacies. At the moment, natural therapies don't and haven't passed that threshold, if you like.
I guess John is saying,
really,
Leanne,
where
that,
we're coming from.
That John is saying too that some of the therapies have passed a higher threshold than others and that they've all been kind of lumped into the same list. What's your response to that?
Yeah, look, I mean, John's absolutely right. There is a broad spectrum in those 16 excluded services. And we know we've got a broad constituency at CHF, as you can imagine. We know that many people like Pilates and yoga, but popular doesn't mean that that's the best thing that we need to be subsidising. That said, CHF is very supportive of translational evidence and evidence that supports services and community access to more services. So the rules around what's in this list aren't set in stone. If fresh evidence emerges, or if there's a different way of presenting the evidence for some of those therapies, as John said, can come to the table and be put to government, then we'd be very supportive of that. Because we know, and particularly with Pilates and yoga, we know that it's a bit of a mantra, but evidence is exercise is medicine, and we want to see in the context of primary care delivery and the sorts of things that GPs offer as well, for good lifestyle risk factor management, exercise being actively encouraged.
And we'll talk a little bit more about those whole of sector issues in a moment. But I wonder if you have a response, Leanne, to John's claims that these laws could make it much more difficult for those therapies to be offered in private hospitals.
Look, certainly sounds like that's the case, but we also understand, and we need to unpack, that we're talking about exclusions from general health, or what used to be called extras health insurance cover. The issue that John seems to be raising relates to the extent to which they're excluded from delivery and rebates in the hospital setting under hospital insurance cover. We might need to check this with the Department of Health, but certainly our understanding is that even before these changes, natural therapies would have been excluded anyway because they weren't eligible for a Medicare rebate then, they're not now, and they would have also required patient admission to hospital. It is complex, as John and yourself are acknowledging.
It is. My brain is swirling at the moment.
Indeed.
I'm speaking with Leanne Wells, CEO of the Consumer Health Forum, and John Wardle, Associate Professor in Public Health at UTS. Now, John, you're a research fellow with the National Health and Medical Research Council, and your focus is on researching natural therapies. What impact are you saying that these changes to the private health insurance system are having on your ability to conduct research into natural therapies?
Look, it essentially means that we can't research how they actually integrate with other aspects of the healthcare system. So Leanne mentioned hospital treatments. I would just add that this extends to outpatient care. So the exclusion from chronic disease management plans and health management plans also mean that even outside the hospitals, integrating with other insured items is not possible. Now, because of this, because most policies are built around. Not just this piece of legislation, but most pieces of legislation. It means that when we do research, we can't actually integrate it with hospital settings, organisations that actually accept insurance for their other items. So we've lost a number of research projects because of this, one of which was actually funded by the NHMRC. One in yoga, one in naturopathy, and one in herbal medicine. So it is actually having an impact. We've already seen this impact. And the reason that we've been told is because they can no longer offer these services if they want to remain compliant with this particular piece of legislation.
So, John, I need to ask, how do you know that these projects weren't stopped for other unrelated reasons?
Oh, well, you know, the organisations in this particular occasion were actually very keen to continue with this research. Contracts had been signed. There'd been press releases put out or prepared, and it wasn't until the lawyers got involved and actually told us that we could not continue, that we stopped continuing, and that's what actually made us actually look into this. This is something that we've been putting into government submissions since I think March last year. So it's not an issue that wasn't foreseen. It was an issue that we warned about in our submissions to government for nearly a year now. So. It was something that we foresaw. It was something that we hoped wouldn't happen, but it is something that has eventuated.
And John, how do you know that the organisations are fully understanding the legal aspects? Are they just a bit scared, or are they saying we definitely can't?
Look, some are saying that they definitely can't. I would probably say that at least one of the organisations is probably being overcautious, but even being overcautious does still have a practical impact. So. You know, there is a the exclusions of natural therapies from integrating with other services is very, very explicit in this legislation. If you read the legislation itself and the amendments, it's very difficult to interpret it any other way. So, the key thing with a lot of these therapies, and you know, I would say that not all of these therapies, but a lot of these therapies do have a very robust evidence base. So, some of the projects that we're actually we're going to go ahead are projects that are either going on in other countries. So our yoga project was a replication of a project in one of the major hospitals in Boston. It's also based on work that the NHS actually requires NHS Trust to actually offer, you know, yoga for low back pain due to the evidence base. So there weren't many other factors that were actually causing people concern about these projects. This piece of legislation came up, and that's the only concern they have. They need to remain compliant with this legislation so that they can continue to be reimbursed for all the other services they offer.
I was interested in the pro-vaccination naturopath research project too. Can you tell us about that one?
Sure. So this is this is probably a little bit separate from the private health insurance discussion. Apart from the fact that the organisation actually interpreted this legislation to mean that any therapies or practices on that list could no longer be incorporated with other services. And because other allied health services were involved in that piece of legislation, they weren't being funded by private health insurance for that particular project, but for other projects that were involving that team, they were. And so they decided not to continue. So that particular project was the one that's funded by NHMRC. We're using, you know, essentially you know, for people that don't trust the medical profession, they're not going to take on public health advice from from the medical profession, but if they have a type of practitioner they trust more, they may trust that advice a little bit more. So it was a very innovative project. There was very robust pilot data supporting good clinical impact of that particular project, but as I said, it was not able to continue.
Leanne Wells, what's your perspective on this? Do you have any concerns about research being curtailed because of these legislative changes?
Look, I'd be surprised if, you know, this legislation was you know, the sole contributor to projects, as John describing, going ahead. I suppose my comment is that we have big health challenges to find better ways of responding to in this country. We've got obesity at record levels. That's a huge concern. Where we want lifestyle risk factor management interventions that are evidence-based brought to the fore, put into play. We've got burgeoning chronic conditions. We've got pain, issues with pain, as John's alluding to. So, look, we're really supportive of translational medical research at CHF. We are an evidence-based organisation, and we want to ensure that the benefits of medical science are applied to healthcare as quickly as possible. So, you know, if research into interventions that are exercise-based in particular for issues like obesity are being curtailed, we would be concerned about that. So you know, what John's describing is a surprise to me. If the legislation in particular has been a contributor there, I don't know whether that's the case or not. I guess one of the things, or the promising things we've got on the horizon that we're all watching with very interested eyes, is the Medical Research Future Fund, and it has funding streams that actually encourage community organisation-led research and NGO organisation-led research, for example, and health system and service development research. So, you know, we, in our submissions to the MRFF and the sorts of priorities it should have across the course of its research spending, and that's over and above, you know, that's investment into health and medical research over and above NH and MRC and other investments, and it's substantial. We really want to see the emphasis on, you know, discovery research, health service and system development research, research that really is community and NGO-led as much as clinician and investigator-led, so that we can start looking at progressive healthcare in this country. We've got a good health system.
But it needs some tweaking is the message
we
there.
We do need to, there's always ways to improve it.
John, we're in an election year. Do you have any indication that the Productivity Commission review that the Federal Labor seems very keen to implement if they win government would lead to any changes that would be positive in your view?
Oh, look, I think if you actually looked at this dispassionately, some of those therapies would be re-included. You know, the notion that this will save money is not actually supported by evidence. There have been a few economic analyses done, and it actually suggests that inclusion of these therapies actually reduces the cost of health insurance on average, largely by bringing new people into the pool, but also some preventive actions like, you know, yoga preventing further surgical initiatives. And the other thing to remember is that, you know, this piece of legislation, it was really about subsidies, but the way that it's written is not about subsidies. It is a prohibitive list, which basically means if you're on that list, you can't be covered. Interestingly, if you're not on that list, you can be covered. So things like Reiki or crystal healing could still be legally covered by private health insurance in Australia. And there are more effective ways of getting the same policy goal without having these unintended flow-on effects. So we've been advocating for a permissive list, so having a level of evidence that natural therapies have to pass and then be included positively in that list, which is the same way that allied health is included, or the Labor Party proposal, which was reporting and readjustment. So Labor proposed allowing insurers to cover whatever they wanted, but then requiring them to report how much they'd spent on those therapies and adjusting the subsidy that way. And I think they probably had in mind potentially bringing other therapies that perhaps shouldn't be subsidised into that arrangement. So that would be a flexible arrangement too. So there are far more effective and far less damaging ways to achieve the same policy goal as what the government has done here, but in a far more effective way.
It will be very interesting to see what this election year brings. And with over $6 billion of public money given to private health insurers this financial year, I'm sure it would be a very big topic of interest. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming on the program today. Leanne Wells.
Thanks, Hilary.
Cheers. Leanne Wells is the CEO of the Consumer Health Forum, and John Wardle is Associate Professor of Public Health at UTS and an NHMRC TRIP Research Fellow. Michael McKenzie, no rolfing for you, but still Reiki.
Okay, thank you very much. That's reassuring. Deborah has texted in amongst many other people to say, surely a key aspect of yoga and Pilates is that these are preventative forms of exercise treatment which will ultimately save the country millions of dollars. It is absurd, from her point of view, to exclude them from rebates. Sue mentions Pilates and yoga and Tai Chi as well and says they're important not only for activity but to combat anxiety. Leah has a different point of view. Have they done a study into how many times a patient has visited a doctor with absolutely no positive outcomes? Linda writes, I'm so fed up with the blackening of alternative health methods. Many of them encourage proactive steps to maintain well-being and take pressure off what she calls the allopathic health system. And when there's talk about just the placebo effect, think about the fact that it means self-healing, says Linda. Natural therapies often support the immune system to activate that process. And someone else says, what a blinkered point of view. So there's a range of views.
And it's such, they're so popular, aren't they? It's regardless of your views on the evidence base, they're incredibly popular across the community. And as the Consumer Health Forum spokeswoman was saying, it's something they're really going to have to look into, whether they should get behind them.
Yeah. And as we've heard, there's some people who are obviously very passionate about having the rights to access those under subsidy if they so choose.
Watch this space. Michael McKenzie, thank you.
Cheers.
And this week on Life Matters, we're marking the 10th anniversary of the Black Saturday bushfires. In a moment, you're going to hear from Ella Holcomb. She was in Melbourne when the fires broke out, but her parents were at Kinglake, defending the home she and her twin brothers had grown up in. Here she shares her own story, as well as reading from a fictionalised picture book she's written for children to mark the anniversary. It's called The House on the Mountain, and it's illustrated by David Cox.
Hello, my name's Ella Holcomb and I grew up in Kinglake. My parents' names were Carol and David Holcomb. My dad was from San Diego in California and moved out to Australia in the late 70s. There was a wave of high school teachers who came out. And so he and my mum met teaching at Layla Secondary College. So when I was born, my parents brought me up to an empty block basically with a very small caravan on it. And we lived there while mum and dad built the shed, lived in the shed for a couple years while they were building their house. The house was this beautiful mud brick house that they built themselves with their friends, timber ceilings, big, big windows that looked down onto the bush, and wooden floorboards, big, heavy old red, kind of red velvet moth-eaten curtains, and big leather armchairs, and yeah, just a beautiful house. I guess they just liked the area, liked the bush. The day before the fire comes seems just like any other. School starts again tomorrow and another hot day stretches out in front of us. In the morning, Mum closes all the windows and pulls the curtains across, trying to keep the heat out. But by lunchtime, outside and inside feel the same. The tired old fan blows warm air around the kitchen, and everything is heavy and still. My twin brothers and I shake off the stillness and disappear into the bush. We chase skinks, poke jumping jack nests, and race down the hill through the dry bracken, Ruby leading the way. Suddenly I realise how far we are from home, but Dad always says, if you get lost, just head back up the hill. And sure enough, I can still see the roof of our house over the trees. We did a lot of just running wild in the bush and a lot of pretend play, pretending that we were shipwrecked and building cubbies. And we used to feel like we were a very, very long way away from the house when we'd go on these adventures. But I was looking at the little track that we used to walk down on, and it's probably less than 50 metres from the house. So we just felt like we were in this vast world and very, very far away and free. But we were actually quite close to the house most of the time. When I wake again, the day is hotter than any I've ever felt. No school today, sweetie, Dad says. Too hot. He doesn't look like he's slept much either. Mum runs us a cold bath, and me and the boys muck around for ages, drenching the bathroom. Mum and Dad go back and forth between the yard and the kitchen, clearing branches and hovering by the radio, turning up the volume as the wind starts to howl outside. The phone rings again and again. Suddenly Mum appears. Her face looks strange. There's a fire coming, she says. We need to move quickly. Mum and Dad start packing bags, grabbing woolen blankets, the first aid kit, torches, and then the photo albums. Dad puts Ruby on her lead and ties her up near the back door. My chest feels hollow, like a birdcage. I remember being aware that we did actually have these bags, like I've described in the book, with the first aid kit and the woolen blankets. As we got older, we became more aware of the things that Mum and Dad were doing in preparation for fire season every year. Dad had sprinklers on the roof. He had a fire pump that he would test every summer. And they also, my parents also went to the CFA meetings in Kinglake and were part of a fire tree in our road, which was like all the different neighbours in the street would call each other if there was any fire danger in the area. So yeah, I was aware, but it wasn't something that we grew up being afraid of. It was just one of those things that, you know, those things as a child that adults will take care of. Yeah. The drive down the mountain hides away in the back of my memories. There is the fierce wind, the crashing of things hitting the car, the skidding of tyres, crying, Dad swearing, and smoke, everywhere the smell of smoke. On the day of the fires, my partner and I were at his parents' place in Ivanhoe because they have a pool. I remember it was very, very hot, and I remember just, you know, being in and out of the pool. We're watching a movie. Yeah, it was V for Vendetta with Natalie Portman. It's a funny thing to remember. And a lot of the rest of the day I don't actually remember. I just remember it was very hot, very windy, just horrible weather, obviously. And at some point my brothers and I got in contact and became aware that there were fires in the area. So we're on the CFA website and kind of on the phone to each other. And I can't remember whether I spoke to my dad or not, but I spoke to my mum a couple times, I think. I remember very little about our earlier conversations in the day, but the last conversation, well, it wasn't really a conversation. The last time I spoke to her, she just said, "We're in really big trouble, I've got to go," and hung up. So at some point my brothers and I and my partner packed the car up and drove up to, well, the intention was to drive up to Kinglake to help Mum and Dad defend the house because that we knew that that was their plan. But luckily the roadblocks were already in place by the time we got to Whittlesea, so we were stopped at the bottom of the mountain. And then we just kind of hung around with everyone else. Yeah, just watching. Like we could, as described in the book, we could see the top of the mountain just on fire. In town, Mum buys us hot chips, but no one eats any. The sky looks strange, dark and glowing, and there is a distant roaring sound, like an aeroplane approaching. We walk to the oval and from there we can see the whole mountain covered in fire. In the evening we go to the community centre next to the oval. There are dogs tied up everywhere outside and cats in crates or loose in the back seats of cars. Lots of kids from school are here too and the twins run around like wild things. So after hanging around in Whittlesea for a couple hours we just drove home back to our share house in Brunswick because there was nothing else that we could do. The fire was Saturday, late afternoon, evening, so all of Sunday and all of Monday I've actually got very little memory of what we did or what happened. I think we might have gone up to Whittlesea again. I think there was a place where you could give the names of people who you were looking for. But yeah, very little memory of what we did. And then very late Monday night, the police came to the house, our place in Brunswick, and told us that Mum and Dad had died, yeah. When I wake, it's light outside and my mouth tastes like dust. What do you mean, gone? I hear Mum whisper. There's a pause. I stay very still. It's gone, love, Dad whispers. The fire got it. I close my eyes again, my heart pounding. I can see our house in the blackness surrounded by trees. I dig my knuckles into my closed eyes, trying to stop the image from disappearing. From memory, it was 1 to 2 weeks until we were able to go up to the block for the first time. I don't think I have actual memories from that day. I mean, I remember what it looked like very early on, and we have photos of what it looked like early on, but that first day up, I don't have actual memories, no. But it, I just remember it looked so unfamiliar and alien, a place so familiar to me that I'd known all my life, just looked completely different, just completely bald. But in the months following the fires, we did start having these pretty wonderful working bees. We were joined by lots and lots of friends and family. So we had these like huge flat metal trays, and we were there like literally sifting through the ashes looking for any bits of pottery or metal. Well, they were basically the things that survived. At first we kept pretty much everything that we found, like crazy people. So we found coins, cutlery, found pots and pottery. Mum and Dad had a big collection of pottery. And also one of my brothers made a lot of amazing pottery when he was in late high school. I think because we had nothing physically left. It was like any tiny bits that we, like kind of physical evidence that we could find, were very important. And as I said, like at the start, we kept everything. And as years have gone by, we've kind of culled a bit. We've, you know, been like, what are we doing with this huge box of rusted metal? We don't need it. So, but we still have the things that are really special. On weekends, we sometimes go back up the mountain with Mum and Dad. One day we have to wear paper masks and bright orange suits, and we watch as huge trucks swing at the remains of our house with their claws. They knock it into smaller and smaller piles before loading it up and driving it away. The rain turns the ash to grey sludge that clumps on our boots. Sometimes it's hard to fall asleep. I miss the sound of rain on the tin roof, the smell of dirt and gum leaves. I can still see our house on the mountain, strong and tall, with its triangle roof and mud brick walls. Sometimes I wake terrified from some forgotten dream, and other times I'm woken by one of my brothers crying out for Mum. There's something inside me that's bigger than fear or sadness. It has no words, no shape, and it turns and twists. In my class, there are 2 kids who don't come back. And in assembly, we talk about all the kids and teachers and families who will never come back. As the 10-year anniversary began to approach, I felt a strong pull to write something in time for that. And I didn't intentionally set out to write a children's book, but it's just kind of how it came out, I think. It was a way of writing that allowed me to kind of pay homage to the amazing childhood that we had. Yeah, I mean, so it's a bit of a thank you to my mum and dad, obviously, for our childhood. And I grew up surrounded by the most amazing picture books. My mum had this really lovely relationship with a woman at, I think it was called Small Print. It's a children's bookstore that used to be in Carlton, I think. And she would go down each year for Christmas and this lady would say, oh, hi, you know, Ella would be ready for this now and Patrick would enjoy this. And yeah, and I just remember that feeling of getting lost in another world of a beautifully illustrated book. After the fires, we were very insular, I'd say, in our grief, like very self-centred almost is not the right word. But as the years went by, you know, we were able to see the bigger picture more, and especially writing this book now, I was more able to think about all the other people who'd been affected and the families who'd been affected, and even families who hadn't, you know, lost members but who might have gone through an experience such as what's in this book. And yeah, I wanted to write something to that as well. I never considered writing my actual story. I had no desire to write a memoir or anything, and once I realised that I did want to write a children's book, it was very clear that it needed to be a different story, a more hopeful story, yeah. In the mornings, the fog rolls up the hill just like it used to. Mum digs over the soil in her old garden beds. Shoots of green are sprouting all the way up the tree trunks, and a few of Mum's plants poke their heads out of the blackened ground. Whenever she discovers one, she calls for us to come and look. Dad says our new house might even be ready by the end of summer. In the evenings, while he cooks dinner, we do our homework at the plastic camping table outside, surrounded by the smell of dirt and gum leaves. At night we can hear the wombats snuffling and scratching next to the caravan, and sometimes an owl calling out into the blackness. We've been very lucky in a way, I think, because my two brothers and I have always been on the same page in terms of the block. There's never been any question that we would sell it or not keep it. So, and then in order to keep it, it made sense to build something on it eventually. So that's what we've just started doing in the last year. The areas that were fire affected are divided up into the different bushfire attack levels or bell levels, and I think it goes up to 4 or 5, and then there's what's called the flame zone, and we were, of course, in the flame zone. So I think something like a third of the cost of our house is these massive bushfire shutters that we have to have. I saw the house recently and it has walls and it has a frame, so I have no idea how long it will take until it's finished, but maybe by the end of this year, that would be wonderful. I don't really have any strong emotions about this new house itself. My connection's always, I think, been more to the block itself. And these are just new things that we're putting on it. Yeah, the connection's more to the land and the bush. I like to remember Mum and Dad when they would have their morning and afternoon tea time. It was very strictly observed, especially on the weekends. So cups of coffee, newspapers, toast or biscuits, and just outside on the little veranda area outside the kitchen. And Mum in the garden, and she was kind of renowned for her daffodils, like kind of a crazy amount of daffodils actually. And every spring she'd pick them, and the kitchen and the laundry would just be filled with like buckets of bunches and bunches of daffodils that she'd organise and take down and give her colleagues at the school she taught at. And Dad was just, he was real goofy and really funny. And I used to teach piano up there on the weekends, and the room where the piano was right next to the kitchen, and he'd often be in there cooking, and he'd just be a bit of a fool. Like, he'd just be there, like, making faces at me, like, when my students couldn't see me, or, like, he liked to, like, sharpen the knives kind of on this knife sharpener thing, and he'd, like, do it in time to the song that they were playing. So he's just a big, big goofball. But, yeah, just super, super loving, both of them. I just remember the house being a place that was full of warmth and love. The sky is endless and impossibly far away, pinpricked with tiny stars. When I stand in the dark where the front lawn used to be and close my eyes, I can still feel our old house reaching its arms around me, and I breathe in time to its memory.
And Ella Holcomb's book is called The House on the Mountain. It's illustrated by David Cox. And the producer on that story was Kathy Pryor.
Fascinated by the mind and how we behave? Then you'll love All in the Mind. In 2019, you'll hear powerful personal stories and insights from great thinkers. We'll explore autism and parenting, mental health in Indonesia, intimacy with AI, and that's just for starters. All in the Mind with me, Lynn Malcolm, at the new time of 12:30 on Sundays and on the ABC Listen app.
You're with Life Matters, Michael McKenzie here, and it's time for this week's health question, which comes from Mel, who asks if soy milk is messing with our hormones and if there are healthier milk alternatives. We're joined by Olivia Willis, who's health reporter for ABC Science. Hey, Liv.
Hi, Michael.
A lot of us tend to think of soy milk. Liv is a healthy option. You can find it in the health food aisle of many major supermarkets. What's it actually made of?
It's funny, a lot of us do tend to think of soy milk as, and I guess any other kind of plant-based milk as a healthier option or a health food. And it's certainly a lot of reason that people make the switch now, not just because they're, you know, lactose intolerant or maybe they want to reduce their carbon footprint. But soy milk, it's essentially made from soybeans and filtered water. So it's kind of taking the milk from soybeans that have been pressed, or in some cases, manufacturers will use a soy protein powder. Mm-hmm. And then they add in things like oils and sweeteners and salt to get it to that similar kind of consistency and flavor as cow's milk. And it's also normally kind of fortified with calcium and vitamin D and certain B vitamins, just so it becomes a good, you know, substitute for cow's milk and a good source of calcium.
Okay. So how does it compare nutritionally to regular cow's milk?
Well, nutritionally speaking, it's pretty on par. Soy milk that's fortified is fairly similar to dairy milk, and that's most of the soy milk that we'd find in the supermarket. I mean, there's no reason why anyone needs to have dairy milk or cow's milk, but it's certainly a good source of protein and calcium. And it's an easy way, I guess, to get a lot of those nutrients that we need in our diet. That's kind of why it's been a cornerstone of Western diets for a long time. Cow's milk is generally, you know, it's naturally a better source of calcium, but like I said, because most soy milks are fortified now with calcium, they're a really decent substitute for cow's milk. Soy milk's a good source of protein, mm-hmm. and soy products, you know, should be a good part of a kind of healthy, balanced diet.
What about fats, comparing milk with milk?
Yeah, so soy milk is it doesn't have, you know, the same, it's lower in fat, it's lower in saturated fat, but milk products generally are fairly low fat. And I guess if you're concerned about the fat content, you know, you've got kind of skim milk as an option. But, you know, that is something, I guess, to take into consideration that, yes, soy milk is lower in fat content.
So soy is also lower in fat, but as I think you mentioned, it's fortified, so along with the natural qualities of soy itself. So you've got iron and fibre, other vitamins and minerals. So is there a kind of recommended blend between dairy and soy in your diet?
Look, I think it's really personal choice. Like, soy is definitely the best kind of substitute for cow's milk. If you're going to not have regular cow's milk in your diet, then soy would certainly be the best option in contrast to other plant-based milks, like almond milks. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
by a long shot.
Well, we'll go back to some of those other milk alternatives in a moment, because a lot of people are opting for those too over soy and dairy. But just back to Mel's original question, she was asking, is soy milk messing with our hormones? And what's the science saying there?
Yeah, so people are a little concerned. There was concern some years ago about this. So soy products contain these things called phytoestrogens, and they're kind of naturally occurring plant chemicals that are chemically pretty similar to the body's natural estrogen, but, you know, they're of a much weaker scale. And soy is not the only food to contain them, but it does have a high concentration of them. And so I guess the discovery of phytoestrogens in soy products led to concerns that they would kind of mimic the effects of our body's own natural estrogen and potentially disrupt, you know, our hormones. And there was a particular concern that was raised some years ago when researchers found basically that these phytoestrogens could increase the risk of cancer in rats. But it's very important to point out that animals, you know, rats have a very different metabolism to humans, and studies in humans do not point to any kind of harmful effects.
And in fact, isn't there some evidence to suggest that soy milk can be beneficial for our health?
Yes, that's right. So there's some research to show that that those phytoestrogens can actually have a protective effect against certain types of cancer. And we know that women, for example, in Japan, who consume a lot of soy foods, they have a lower risk of cancer. But again, those studies are kind of inconclusive at this point. So we don't know for sure whether there is a protective effect. But, you know, the Cancer Council encourages people certainly to have soy-based foods as part of a kind of varied and nutritious diet. But yeah, if anything, soy products, yeah, would have a kind of preventative effect, rather than a harmful effect. There's no evidence of that.
So would it be fair to say at the moment, when it comes to any pros or cons surrounding the science behind soy milk, the jury is still out? It's a little inconclusive at the moment.
It's inconclusive around whether it can have a preventative effect in terms of cancer, but it's not inconclusive as to whether it's harmful. We know, you know, that's pretty clear that it's not harmful, and certainly incorporating soy products and soy milk into your diet is a good thing.
I'm Michael McKenzie. This is Life Matters. We're talking about which milk is healthier for you. And we've been asking on Facebook as well what kinds of milk you choose to drink, because there is a bewildering choice out there. You can leave your comment on Facebook. My guest is Olivia Willis, health reporter for the ABC Science Unit. Liv, for people who don't want to or can't drink regular dairy milk, is soy milk, and I think you mentioned this earlier, is it the next best thing?
It is definitely the next best thing. So there was actually a study a couple of years ago looked exactly into this question. What are the nutritional differences, I guess, between cow's milk? And I think they looked at four other popular plant-based milks, so soy, almond, rice milk and coconut milk. And it found that far and away soy fared the best. It rated the highest because it's, you know, it's rich in protein and fiber. And as I mentioned before, it's fortified with calcium. So it's a really good substitute. I think the next best thing was almond milk.
Mm-hmm.
But I would stress that these other plant-based milks are not a great, nutritionally speaking, they're not a great alternative. So you may want to consume them. You know, they're better, for example, than soft drinks. But if you're looking to get the nutrients,
that's faint praise, Liv, I've got to say. Okay. So we're talking here about things like rice milk, coconut milk, oat milk as well.
Yeah. So rice milk, for example, that's kind of comparable to cow's milk in terms of calories, but it also tends to be pretty rich in sugar. So it's kind of a fairly high sugar carbohydrate kind of drink. Almond milk, as I mentioned, I think they had that next best to soy, but, you know, it's low in protein, it's low in carbohydrates. These products aren't fortified in the same way. And coconut milk, that tends to be quite high in saturated fat. Like, we know coconut oil, for example, has a lot of saturated fat in it. So, and it's also pretty low in protein. So the thing about these milks is, you know, they're, I think I, because I picked up a bottle of almond milk just the other day in the supermarket, and it's 2.5% almonds. but it's got, like, in terms of the whole makeup of the product, it's 2 to 3% of what it says on the actual packaging.
So what's the rest of it?
Water. Okay. Mostly water. Yeah. And various other bits and pieces. But like I said, they're a better option than other kind of sugary drinks and whatever, but they're not good substitutes for dairy milk. If you're wanting an actual substitute for cow's milk, then the best bet is soy milk. Of course, there's some people that can't have soy either. And so yes, almond milk would be the best option there. But yeah, it's kind of important to know that they're generally, there's not a lot in them. They're mostly water, filtered water.
All right. And I also know that it's quite a very, very old commercial, oils ain't oils, because when it comes to mix my metaphors here with milks, my youngest daughter, who's a huge fan of almond milk, for example, says there are some brands of almond milk she won't drink because she just doesn't like not only the taste but what they're made of. And the same with soy, that some soy, as you mentioned, comes from powder, some comes from actual soy bean and curd. So, yeah, you can shop around and choose brands one over the other.
That's it. It definitely pays to look on the packaging. And, you know, even for soy milks, as your daughter pointed out, there's, you know, it might be a powder-based one, and they might use particular sugars in there. So it's worth having a look on the packaging to check what kind of stuff they're putting in it.
Okay, Liv, thanks so much for that. It's great.
No problem.
That's Olivia Willis, who is an ABC health reporter, and she was helping us answer our questions about soy milk. And that question, of course, came from Mel, who was wondering about the hormone content of soy milk and the impact it has on our bodies. It sounds like there's no need to worry there, Mel. If you have a question about health or sustainable living, you can send us an email, lifematters@abc.net.au, or you can message us on Facebook or at RN Life Matters. Hillary, hello.
Hello, Michael. A lot of response about our story on healthcare, but almost as much on milk, I have to say. From Facebook, Mike the Bike says, plain whole milk. Everything else is not milk. And Kristen says, full-fat cow's milk because of its nutrient profile and taste.
Right, there you go. Guillaume also says that he, I think, prefers rice milk because he thinks the dairy industry is cruel. And Dave says on Facebook, small amount of cow milk in my tea and nothing else. Don't like it at all, he said. Never drank it as a kid. I think also Shirley from Canberra has weighed into that conversation you had earlier about the government withdrawing subsidy for some of those, what's considered by some as fringe health benefits under the policies of private health. Shirley says in Canberra, there's always limited resources in health budgets. Government subsidies in health should therefore only be for evidence-based treatments. This in no way, she says, suggests doing yoga, Pilates, Tai Chi, running, swimming, or playing ping pong, are not good for health. They are, but should not be subsidised by the public purse, which is a shame because I've just bought a ping pong table.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Timing, Michael,
yeah,
is everything.
Yeah, I know.
Jonathan says, I find it hard to understand how your presenter this morning can say that homeopathy is now totally debunked. The practice of homeopathy was founded in the late 1700s. Homeopathy is the most widely practiced form of medicine in the world. If it didn't work clinically, it would never have gained so much popularity. To rule homeopathy out is misinformed about its history, philosophy, and success to treat illnesses both chronic and acute, says Jonathan. I am a homeopath and I don't agree with this legislation.
And also, we've had some more responses, not only on milk, but on these kinds of fringe benefits as seen by some for health policies. But just quickly, I'll finish on this one, if I may. This is on Robin from Robin on milk. King Island, she says, makes the best milk, but we can't buy it to drink. It all goes to make that prize-winning cheese everyone loves to eat. So she's feeling like, I think, there's benefits anyway.
So unfair. Yeah. Thank you, Michael.
Cheers.
And just finally to the segment on the Black Saturday fires, says one correspondent, was absolutely beautiful and heartbreaking. Thank you to the young woman and to the RN team for putting that together. Our pleasure. Next time on Life Matters, the 10th anniversary of the Black Saturday bushfires is an opportunity to reflect on how people and communities get through disasters. What helps you recover in the weeks, months, and years that follow? We'll hear stories from people affected by disasters all around Australia and check the latest research about what strategies work best, because it's not one size fits all when it comes to trauma recovery. Join me for that next time on Life Matters here on RN.